Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Luis Alberto Urrea. He is a poet, essayist, novelist. He is the author of 11 books and is probably, though, best known for two out of those 11. One is The Devil's Highway, was published in 2004, a nonfiction book that tells the story of a group of Mexican immigrants lost in the Arizona desert. Got a lot of favorable response, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also author of a novel, The Hummingbird's Daughter, which many, many people read and enjoyed, and I certainly did. And by the way, if you'd like to hear him talk about that, you can go to our web archive. He teaches creative writing at the University of Illinois Chicago, and we'll talk this morning about his most recent novel, which has just now been out a couple of months. Into the Beautiful North is the title, and it's published by Little Brown. So questions are welcome at some point. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, you certainly should feel welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, the toll-free line that would be good for anybody who would be making a long-distance call is 800-222-9455. So any point here, you have call, you want to call, you pick up the telephone and let us hear from you. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Urrea, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. And yourself?
I'm fantastic.
Good. I'm really glad that you could talk with us today. I hope you're not getting tired after having done so many interviews and talked to so many people about the book.
Well, it's been a really incredible book tour, but I've been home for about 3 days, so I'm getting back in the groove, you know?
Good. Well, and you know, when the book came in, before I actually looked at it closely, I saw the book and I saw your name on it, and I thought, aha, this is a sequel to The Hummingbird's Daughter. And I know there will be one, but this is a different story.
Yeah, this is a different story. It's been funny because some people who expected the sequel right away were sort of shocked, I think, that it wasn't. But, you know, it's an interim project that was really interesting to me. And it just felt like a bit of a holiday, you know. It was kind of a fun book to write. And I thought in these troubled times it might be a good thing for readers to have a laugh, you know.
Yeah, well, and that it struck me as the way that you've been talking about it. The book has been well received, and apparently a lot of people who have read the book said they really enjoyed it. And you've said, well, that really makes you happy, that you're glad that they enjoyed it and it took them away from whatever kind of troubles they might have been thinking about right at the moment, and that perhaps contrasts with the spirit of this book, perhaps contrasts with at least with Devil's Highway, which is a very serious book. And in a way, Hummingbird's Daughter is a bigger sort of project, maybe a bigger story. And I know that it's something that you worked on for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But it gets me back to the idea of, well, you know, what are stories for, really? And should we have to somehow apologize for a story that maybe mostly is just entertaining?
You know, it's funny because if you look at certainly my work, people keep asking me, why is this book so funny? And I think, well, gosh, I thought all my books were funny. Even Devil's Highway has moments of humor in it. But, you know, my take on this is an odd one, and I will paraphrase William Burroughs and Laurie Anderson. You know, they said language is a virus. I think laughter is a virus, and laughter infects us with humanity. You know, it's a thing that unites us more than breastfeeding, I think, more than preaching, more than moaning and sorrow and guilt. I think it's laughter. It humanizes us and unites us and makes us understand that we really are a family here on the earth. And in that way, I think the book was part of the, for me, part of the healing work that Hummingbird's about, you know. But on the other more light side, I just wanted to write an entertainment. I feel like I'm trying to enter Graham Greene territory, you know. he wrote serious novels and entertainments, and at least he was honest enough to put entertainment on the book cover. So perhaps when I write, you know, any more books in that vein, I'll have it called an entertainment.
Well, and it makes me think of you know, maybe other conversations I've had with writers where we've gotten into some kind of discussion of the term literary fiction and what that is, and that I think a lot of people actually would like to avoid a term like that because as far as they're concerned, there are stories and maybe there are good stories and less good stories. And mostly I think what people are trying to do is just to tell a good story.
I hope so. I mean, certainly for me, story comes first. You know, all of my other obsessions and interests and all that are secondary to trying to give the reader a good experience. And that's because I'm a selfish reader myself. You know, I come from a working class, blue-collar family. My dad was a janitor, basically, in bowling alleys where I grew up, in the back of bowling alleys playing with the machines. And, you know, I was a guy who wanted to read a good book. And I still remember I was fortunate in that my mom was very literate and literary and had exposed me to Mark Twain. And, boy, that just put me around the bend. But from Mark Twain to Ray Bradbury, you know, once I got the Ray Bradbury bug, I was hooked on story forever.
What do you think makes a good story?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm not a real master of plot. I seem to tell real shaggy dog stories that meander, but I'm really enamored of characters, you know, interesting interactions between people, interesting locations, you know, as you know, where you're at. And by the way, my boy, Marching Illini, so I feel really close to Champaign-Urbana, but you know, the book ends in Kankakee, and and it seemed to me that if I could write a book about the admittedly fairly easy job of writing about a magical Latin American village, I mean, every writer in the world writes that, and then balance it with a magical Midwestern town, I thought that was interesting. You know, I thought Kankakee has as much magic in it as this invented Mexican village of Tres Camarones. And maybe Kankakee needs its magic realist, you know, to sing its praises, which was, honestly, you know, Ray Bradbury writing about Illinois when he was a younger writer.
Well, see, this is very interesting because I was thinking about this at we can talk a little bit more about the story, but the main character is a girl named Nayeli.
And Nayeli.
Part of the story is all about her going to search for her father, who is one of the many men of this village, Tres Camarones, who have gone north, gone to the United States looking for work.
Yeah.
And at one point, early on, she has, I think all she has is a postcard.
That's it.
That he had sent to her and it's funny because you think, as a reader, I think of Tres Camarones and Sinaloa and the places that you write about as being strange and exotic. Well, here she's got a postcard from Kankakee, and I'm sure to her, Kankakee, Illinois probably sounds as exotic and strange, and you wonder about, well, what's this place like, as much as to me, Tres Camarones, it seems also strange and exotic.
Yeah, you know, it's something that hadn't even occurred to me. And first of all, it's really interesting because outside of our area, a lot of people have no idea what Kankakee is, and journalists, when they interview me, have often called it Kankakee. And they say to me, what's your obsession with Kankakee? but it occurred to me when we started translating the books back into Spanish and sending them back into Mexico, I work with my cousin, who's Enrique Hubbard Urrea, which is a great little thing in and of itself, but he's the Mexican consul general in Texas. He's a former ambassador to the Philippines and Brazil. He's a very accomplished international politician in the Mexican government, and he's a really good translator and a good writer, but he said something to me that really knocked me for a loop, and he said, you know, it's really funny the way you have represented Mexico to the United States. You're kind of an ambassador to us, but, you know, now you're representing the United States to Mexico, and all the things that you offer to the United States that are sort of magical and exotic, the reverse is true in Mexico. Many of the things you talk about, we already know, but when you talk about the U.S., wow, that's really strange. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, the Midwest to a tropical Mexican villager is so exotic, you know, it's full of magic. It never occurred to me. So, you know, not to belabor the Ray Bradbury point, but it made me remember things like Dandelion Wine and Something Wicked This Way Comes. You know, I was a San Diego boy, right? Born in Tijuana, raised in San Diego. I'd never been back east. So just things like fall and corn and snow and winter were so exotic to me that I realized that that's part of the task for this book. I'm showing two sides, I think, of the magic of our existence. You know, that we're living, we don't always remember that we're living a miracle. Every minute of our lives is a massive gift, even in the dark hours. And I think we forget. And so I just wanted to represent the miracle in both directions.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Luis Alberto Urrea. He's a professor of creative writing at University of Illinois Chicago, is an essayist, poet, novelist. His most recent book is Into the Beautiful North, and it's published by Little Brown. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You did some of your growing up in both the United States and Mexico.
Yeah.
And I know that you spent time when you were a boy, particularly, I guess, in the summertime in the village where your dad had grown up, and
right.
that the village in the book, Tres Camarones, is in very large part based on this real place.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Let's see. Well, you know, my dad's actual town is called Rosario, Sinaloa, and it's a classic magic realist joint. I mean, you know, it's a little town in the very south end of the state, about 10,000 people, cobblestone streets, everybody knows each other. And I had this weird opportunity because my uncle, the Hubbard, great patriarch, owned the only radio station, newspaper, and movie theater. So I had this really blessed existence from going from abject poverty, you know, kind of ghetto child, to this world where these guys were the kings. And it sort of unlocked this village for me in ways that I didn't even understand until later. And it was a place full of this odd, funky magic, you know, giant iguanas. And you'd go out in the morning with a pole and knock mangoes out of the tree for your breakfast, you know. And there was a village, a simpleton who rode around on a bike all day long, who just loved me to death. And he would show up at the weirdest hour or the weirdest places on this bike, and he would hand me things like vegetables, or he'd show up with an eggplant, and one day he brought me a snapping turtle, and when I tried to take the snapping turtle, it bit my thumb and wouldn't let go, and I you know, had this snapping turtle attached to my thumb for about an hour. Then you'd go back home to San Diego, and you'd think about this stuff and think, wow, that is so strange, you know. And I it didn't even occur to me that I could write about it in the early years, because I was busy writing poems about girlfriends, pretty much, you know. But it started seeping in when I realized that it was a fabric of story that was, you know, inside me, and apparently has come away as a permanent fixture of my psyche.
Mm-hmm. The central character here is, as I say, is this girl, Nayeli, and she is a strong character. And I guess, you know, one of the things that really strikes me, well, the books, they're both really full of strong characters, but somehow they seem to be really about women and about their experience. And certainly there are a lot of strong women in these stories.
Yeah.
Inspired, I would expect, at least in some part, by women that you have known. Is there something particularly that draws you to wanting to write about women and the way they experience the world?
I like women. you know, it's just the luck of the draw in a certain way. You know, I've written a bunch of books, many of them about guys. You know, Devil's Highway was certainly all male all the time, pretty testosterone soaked. But you know, after 20 years of working on Hummingbird's Daughter about women's sacredness and women healers and so forth, I was, I think, into that groove, and I was thinking about women characters in my life, you know. And I was actually, as I say in the notes at the end of Beautiful North, I was keeping an eye on this group of teenage girls that I've been around because of my daughter, and listening to them interact. And it struck me as really funny the way they kid each other and chide each other and betray each other and support each other all at the same time. And so when the time came to start writing this story, it just, you know, it was just, like I say, luck of the draw. And the motivating factor in writing the book was the stories about these villages in Mexico that have no men left. And women have been stepping up and having to fill this void, sometimes for the first time ever, that, you know, they are becoming mayors and leaders and so forth in the absence of patriarchy. But, you know, one of the interviewers early in the book tour asked me if I was writing chick lit, and I thought, wow, really? That's strange. You know, I was just writing about people, and women happen to be human beings too, you know, and that they're part of this story. And certainly Hummingbird, the sequel, is the next book. So I'll be firmly established as having written three strongly female books. So I guess the next one will have to be testosterone driven. I'm not sure.
The thing that sort of, I think for you, was the roots of the story, at least one of the things that got you thinking in the ways that led to the book, is something that apparently you see a lot in small villages and towns around Mexico, and that is that the men are gone. They've left. They've gone to the United States to try to find work, and essentially the place is left to be run by and taken care of by the women.
Right. It's a really fascinating thing to watch. It's kind of a groundswell of what I call folk feminism. You know, women who have not really considered taking power or leading or running things. And suddenly these guys are gone. Somebody has to do it. And they're starting to step into the role, you know. And I think one of the ironies in my book is that these women in my story decide, after seeing the Magnificent Seven, to come to the United States and get seven men to bring back to do battle to protect their town from drug dealers, not quite knowing, I think, until perhaps the very end, that perhaps they could have done it themselves without having to get the men. But, you know, the comedic engine of it is that they think that people in the United States will embrace them because they've come to remove people. They're not
bringing people. No, yeah, they're taking people back.
Exactly. They think, wow, the Border Patrol, they're really going to like us because we're coming to take guys away. It's going to be a heroic act.
I think it's particularly wonderful. Actually, I sort of have a soft spot myself for that movie. And I think, though, it's particularly wonderful that you've taken that and put that into the story, that here in this town, and I'm sure that the experience would be the same in a lot of places. And, in fact, the real place where the movie theater was an important thing.
Oh,
Everybody went every week. That was a major form of entertainment, and saw movies that were made in the United States and probably dubbed into some other language other than English, and so that people could watch it. But I think it's particularly wonderful that movie, that old chestnut, you put it into the story, and the girl says, well, heck, we could, why not? We can do that. Let's go find Yul Brynner.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I've always wanted to write a book about that experience, the tropical movie theater, but I think Cinema Paradiso kind of did that, so I haven't. But, you know, my movie agent calls this book Cinema Paradiso Meets the Magnificent Seven for Girls.
I like that a lot.
Which is great.
I like that a lot.
You know, my uncle had this movie theater, the Cine Pedro Infante, that theater is based on, and it's true that we would go to the movies almost every night. Probably every other night he had a double feature, because many of the people in town didn't have TVs and the movies were really cheap. And you would get these really bizarre cinematic experiences. You know, I saw 2001 there. If you can imagine 2001 in this little tropical village with bats in the movie theater, and then afterwards these sort of drunken rooftop beer-soaked conversations with cousins who were pondering the nature of outer space and eternity, it was just magnificent. And the whole thing about the Western showing was, actually inspired by seeing The War Wagon. You remember that?
John Wayne, sure.
Kirk Douglas. But, you know, it came and it was dubbed into German, and it had different subtitles across the bottom. Some were Asian, and the Asians were blotted out by Spanish. But I remember John Wayne walking in rooms and saying things like, "Mach schnell," you know, "Raus," and I couldn't stop laughing. And they were like, what's so damn funny? What's the matter with you? And it was, you know, it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen. And it was well before people like Monty Python showed up. But, you know, it was a classic experience of international absurdity. So when I thought about this town, it really pleased me to think that this uber macho kind of movie would inspire these 19-year-old women to go out there and kick some butt themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's earlier you mentioned that when you were younger, one of your favorite writers was Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
And it's funny, you mentioned the Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I haven't thought about that book for a long time, but at one time I was very fond of that book. And I think it's maybe one of his less well-known books. Certainly, you know, I suppose everybody reads The Martian Chronicles, and everybody reads The Illustrated Man.
The Illustrated Man, yeah.
But I'm not so sure about that one. But I really like that book a lot, and I think the reason that I liked it was partly, I think, for the mood and the tone of it that I like very much. But it strikes me now that maybe that book, maybe like some things that Twain wrote and maybe like some things that you've written, is a very old story form, because it's about characters who are on the precipice of adulthood, who have one foot in childhood yet and one foot in adulthood.
Yeah.
And about that being such a charged, frightening, exciting time in a person's life.
Yeah, I think it's a mystical portal almost. And, you know, I mean, interestingly enough, Hummingbird's Daughter is really the same territory. It didn't occur to me, but I don't think that story could have happened if she had not been in her teens, you know, the Teresita, the Saint of Cabora. And she only lived to be 33, so she never really got far beyond that. So the sequel of that book is the other side of that, when she's made it past 19 and is now trying to be an adult. But I think that moment, that twilight moment, not to call up the vampire books, but that twilight moment between childhood and adulthood is an amazing time. And a lot of my own quests and madnesses happened at that time. You know, my father was killed at that age in my life at the hands of the Mexican cops, and I didn't know what to do with myself, and somehow ended up working as a missionary in Mexico. I don't know if it even makes sense, but somehow his death knocked me off the rails so much that I think I was seeking meaning or some sort of revelation or something, and I ended up as a translator for this missionary group in Tijuana.
Hmm. You know, it strikes me, I think maybe for a lot of adults, they don't have a whole lot of sympathy or understanding or resonance, I think, for that time, which is why maybe they have a tough time with teenagers. I don't know. It seems, though, that's something that you have more sympathy for. And I think that a lot of there are writers who do. And actually, I think it's because part of them never quite left that time.
Yeah.
You know, that they're still the part, you know, their heart, a big part of their heart is still there.
I think so. I mean, you know, you'd have to ask my teenagers about that, because they just think I'm a boring jerk, you know, who makes them take out the trash. But, you know, I think especially for writers or any kind of artist, I mean, you think about musicians. What do they do for a living? They play music. And I always tell my students at UIC, you know, if you get to make a career of literature, it's the closest thing you can do to going to recess for a living. You know, it's so pleasurable to me to open a notebook or to get a pen or to go in my writing area and turn on some cherished music and to sit down to a project. That is absolute fun. And so for me to be able to actually have fun for a living is incredible. And I'm you know, I'm on my knees in thanks all the time for that. Now, the other side of that coin is the actual writing career, which isn't that much fun. And, you know, you face all the adult challenges. But to pursue the creativity and what's inside of your mind and heart is just, it's a blessing beyond compare.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Luis Alberto Urrea. He's professor of creative writing at University of Illinois Chicago. He's author of 11 books. He's an award-winning poet and essayist. His book, The Devil's Highway, from 2004, this is a nonfiction account of a group of Mexican immigrants lost in the Arizona desert. That was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, won the 2004 Lannan Literary Award. He is also the author of The Hummingbird's Daughter, a novel that many, many people, including me, read and enjoyed very much, that is going to be made into a movie, in fact. They're going to start, I think, in the fall. There will be a sequel, and he is also the author of a brand-new novel that is much in the spirit of the Hummingbird's Daughter. The title is Into the Beautiful North, and it's recently been published by Little Brown. It's out now, so you certainly should go out and look at these books. I think that you would really enjoy reading them. And questions are welcome, too, here. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think that a lot of your characters are, in part, shaped by, inspired by people that you know.
Yeah.
And family. And Nayeli is there's a little bit, I guess, of your daughter and her friends in her. There's also in Nayeli's Aunt Irma is, I guess, a little bit inspired by, you have an Aunt Irma.
Yeah. Yeah, I have an Aunt Irma, all right, who's, she's pretty scary, honestly. She was Mexico's women's bowling champion. She's always been a force of nature in our family. And she scares some of the cousins so much they call her Uncle Irma. Because she's so, she's tough and really mean. But I thought at the time when I was working on this book, if she were still in the village instead of off in Mexico City and so forth, who better to be the first woman mayor than this bowling champion, this juggernaut of a character? But, you know, she is a cartoon if she just remains the insane powerhouse. And so, you know, she also has a secret life. And part of the journey north that she bankrolls and pushes as a political necessity for the village is the fact that she has lost a sweetheart to the north herself, and she's hoping the girls will find this man who was her only love, because the secret is she's not strong enough herself to go.
Yeah.
So she's relying on the strength of the young girls, which, you know, to me, I always think about Japanese poets and writers, and that's the secret formula in my stuff. I always tell people Hummingbird's Daughter is about 25,000 haiku in a row, you know. But I think about their old rule of wabi-sabi, which was, you know, the humor and the pathos of life, the fleeting sorrow of life. And so that added the wabi-sabi to me, that here this powerful, ferocious woman, the reality is that she's a softie underneath and doesn't have the strength to face her own pain. And so she's willing to sacrifice the young people of the village to try to help her find what she has lost.
Yeah. So somebody in the book, in referring to her, says she's something like muy hardcore.
Yeah, es muy hardcore.
Es muy hardcore. Yes. There's another character in here that is apparently based on someone that you knew. One of the important characters, a man in this village, one of the few men. His name is Tacho.
Tacho.
And he is gay. He is openly gay.
Yeah.
At which I'm sure in that world is not easy, because so much emphasis is put on maleness and masculinity.
Exactly.
And this apparently, again, is this man is based, at least in part, on a man named Tacho, who actually lived in that town, your dad's town, the place where you spent the summers.
Yeah, I am. I'm really gratified that Tacho has met with approval, you know, and a lot of gay people have been really happy about Tacho, and that makes me happy, because, you know, you don't want to write something inadvertently insulting or stupid or whatever. But yeah, that character is definitely an homage to this real guy. That's why I gave him the same name. And what moved me about this guy is, you know, it's this little town south of Sinaloa, very macho, very patriarchal. And here's this one lone and lonely gay man out. And I think he realized early on, or decided early on, that there was no way to hide who he was, and there was no way to ever live in peace if you apologize for who you were. So he put it in everybody's face. Bam, yeah, I'm Tacho. What are you going to do about it? Yeah, I'm gay. What are you going to do about it? And it made him a fixture in this town. He was such a big character that they recognized him almost as a macho figure. They used to call him Tachito el Machito. You know, that he was so in your face that nobody dared give him a hard time, and it made him famous. And I didn't, you know, the family sort of kept me away from him a little bit. They would sort of regard him as an exotic creature. Oh, look, there goes Tacho. But I think they had their own doubts about me because I was American, you know, and I didn't have a harsh enough accent, and I didn't smoke, and they got me drinking, which was pretty remarkable because I was 12 when they first started giving me tequila and stuff. But I was not passing whatever macho test they had, so I was really interested to watch how he negotiated that. And I met him finally, really met him in 1980, Christmas Eve. He used to sell women's shoes out of his house, and my girl cousins would go to Tacho, and they would get fashion advice from him. And so they took me to buy some shoes and purses, and we finally spoke. So I thought of him when I was making this character, and I did it. And my cousin, who you know, did the translating work, they sent him the Spanish version of the book. And I got, right before leaving on tour, I got this email saying he has become insufferable because he is now the hero of an American novel, which made me really happy.
That is such a great story. Well, and again, I guess it comes back to the idea that it seems that you're, one of the things that you're interested in is people who are, you know, we get these job descriptions handed to us about what a man is and what a woman is and how you're supposed to behave and what you're supposed to do and what you can do and what you can't do. And it seems that you're interested in people who want to say, well, yeah, well, okay, I got another idea for you, and who are challenging the job description.
I think we're all that way, though. See, you know, I really admire people of integrity. And that could be political integrity, religious integrity, moral integrity. I don't know. Any person who knows who they are, what they believe, or where they stand, and they're true to it. You know, and that is something that you find, especially I think here in the Midwest. You know, people are what they are, and they're not apologetic for it. And it really touches me when I find people like that. And I think we without even knowing it, dictate the parameters of who we are and what we are. And sometimes we're not successful at it, and sometimes we're laughed at or mocked or beat up for it. But we try to be true to ourselves, you know. And I'm always touched out here. Well, look at Kankakee, you know, what the people in Kankakee are like and how they treat us, my family and me. Is amazing. Or, you know, here in the neighborhood, just to give you an idea, I live in Naperville, right, west of Chicago. And while we were gone, those giant storms came through, knocked our pine tree over in our neighbor's house. So we got back from our trip, and we're trying to figure out how to get this pine tree taken care of. And who shows up but an FBI agent, friend of ours, and he proceeds to dismantle the tree for us with chainsaws. And all the neighbors come out and help him haul this tree off the neighbor's roof and tear it apart. I didn't ask anybody to do that. And you would think, you know, I was wearing I told him, I've got some sort of communist T-shirt on. some sort of barrio resistance T-shirt that somebody gave me. And he said, no, we got rid of those guys in 1982. It's okay. He took the whole tree apart for me. And all the neighbors, like I said, came out. And you know, it's a really funny thing because in this neighborhood, I'm certainly the only writer. I'm probably one of the only two Hispanics. I'm no question the only liberal. But none of that matters to anybody because we're neighbors, and so we all look out for each other. And I'm not used to that. I'm used to, as I told him, you know, in where I grew up, if a pine tree had fallen over and left a big hole in the ground, the homies would be trying to figure out if they could get down the hole into the basement to steal your TV. But they wouldn't be coming over here to help a neighbor out in trouble. And that really, you know, that little touch of humanity is what moves me all the time, that we can be people, we can be a family together, no matter what we believe or, you know, where we're from or whether we're strangers or not. We share humanity. We share the travails of being alive.
Our guest is Luis Alberto Urrea. He's a professor of creative writing at University of Illinois Chicago. He's authored 11 books. The nonfiction Devil's Highway was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize when it came out. It was an account of a group of Mexican immigrants who were lost in the Arizona desert. His novel Hummingbird's Daughter, very, very well received, an excellent book. It's going to be made into a movie. His newest novel is Into the Beautiful North. It's just recently out, published by Little Brown. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. That, you know, your last comments, I guess, invites the kind of question that says, well, how is it that we're somehow going to be able to manage the challenges of being this big family that we call Americans? And I don't mean just people from the United States.
Yeah.
I mean,
the
like
America.
People, the Americas.
Yeah.
For some time now, and I guess we should expect to continue to be for some time now, for a lot of people, a big issue is going to be that very thing, and particularly the issue of people who are coming with permission and without to the United States, mostly without permission, the people who are coming here because they're trying to support themselves, they're trying to support their families, and so they come. And, you know, the big question is, what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, I think it's a worldwide question. You know, borders are trembling and crumbling all over the planet, and, the paradigms shift constantly. For example, the immigration question is obviously a vexing and disturbing question in which I find myself buried sometimes because I end up having to write about it, you know. But people, oddly enough, are extremely kind and open. I've talked literally to tens of thousands of people the last couple of years now. I go out on the road once, twice, even three times a month talking because people want to talk. And I very rarely have people attack or yell or anything. They want to discuss. They want to know strategies. They want to hear about how do we deal with this stuff equitably. There's a lot of, clearly a lot of burden upon the Mexican government, for one, to step up. But also, you know, I've been saying for a couple of years that your real issue is not going to be immigration very soon. It's going to be narco war, and that seems to be happening now. You know, the immigration numbers have dropped pretty sharply. The enforcement issues have changed on the border quite a bit. So I think the combination of economic downturn, stepped up security on the border, and terror of the drug war has definitely slowed down the immigrant flow north pretty severely. It has also, unfortunately, I think, slowed the return home. Before the downturn hit, before the narco war really flared up, I met with some people from the World Bank who were the experts on the remittance monies, you know, going back into Mexico and Latin America from the United States. And it had dropped from $20 billion at its highest point to down into the millions, and nobody could figure out what was going on. And the World Bank, their remittance money researchers had decided that the workforce in the United States, much of it was getting ready to start heading home, that they had made their nest egg and were, you know, had been here long enough, a lot of them, to look at a kind of retirement. And the Mexican government certainly didn't want that and were trying to find many ways to keep people here. So they've been quite cynical, I think, in their approach to this, but they've shot themselves in the foot in that they helped foment this blowing off of steam, right? This social problem of a disaffected class with no opportunities, well, send them north and get them out of here, and then we suddenly don't have a social problem. But what they did was lost a generation of hard workers, the young, strong, able-bodied workers that are no longer there. That's a problem for them. You know, as far as enforcement goes, you see, for example, the region I wrote about in the Devil's Highway, the Welton Station, they had 32 agents when I wrote that book. They have about 300 to 350 agents now. And they had to tear down Welton Station and build a huge new complex, ironically enough, to hold the agents. The number of people coming was dropping, but the force on the border was expanding. Very interesting paradigm. But I think, you know, they're under a lot of danger now that they weren't under before, as the criminal element has overwhelmed the border and overwhelmed, I think, the challenges that those agents face.
Yeah. You know, at one point, I think early on here in the book, Tia Irma is talking about, and she, what's really striking and kind of funny and sort of ironic is that she's saying the kinds of things that I would expect people in the southwestern United States to say.
Yeah.
About people coming from the South, and there she's talking about, well, I guess people coming from Central America, people coming
exactly.
up into Mexico, making that same, they're going into maybe they think they're going into the beautiful North the same way that people think they're coming in the United States, which makes me wonder, well, in fact, in Mexico, can you catch people saying the same stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
You know, if you listen to Mexican talk radio, for example, mm-hmm. it sounds a lot like American right-wing talk radio. You hear these guys, you know, sounding like Sean Hannity or one of those characters, you know, where they're saying, wait a minute. These guys are coming here, they're taking our jobs, they're taking our benefits, they're getting a free education, they're not part of our culture. All the things you hear said, in fact, I've heard them say, what we need is a wall on the southern border to stop them from coming in, those wily Guatemalans and Hondurans and
yeah,
so forth.
That's amazing. Well, to come back to writing a little bit, I think that you've said that you feel that in this place, I mean the real place, and Tres Camarones and these people, you think that there's a big bank of stories here that it would expect to keep drawing on?
You know, I think it'll never go away. I didn't expect to be Mr. Border Boy, you know. But it kind of reflects my own existence. I feel like the border sort of divided my own home, you know, with an American mom and a Mexican dad who really didn't get along very well, so they had an unfriendly border down the middle of our apartment, you know. But I'm really interested in everything. And I've been able to move out of it, certainly in poetry and in my short stories. And I think being able to write about Kankakee is part of my own emancipation. I mean, I would love to, and I got to say, I'm partly imprisoned by my name, but I would love to be able to write about my mother's world too. And I think mm-hmm. that's in the future. Once I get done with Hummingbird 2, then all other possibilities open up to me. It would be so much fun for me to write a novel about, you know, a family in Matituck, Long Island. Though I don't know if my readers would accept that or not. You know, they'd be like, where are the parrots? Where's the hot sauce?
Well, that's, I guess, what's just, and this is, obviously, this has gone into making who you are, that I think it's just a remarkable sort of mixture of cultures and inspirations. And, you know, when you talk about the border running through your house, I know you've talked about that this is not just a metaphor. This was almost a literal fact on the ground, as your dad was Mexican, your mother was American. At one time, they may well have been in love, but when things soured, they decided that, well, they had you and they needed to look out after you, so they would stay together. But they didn't have much use for each other otherwise. And as you describe it, the idea that there was a border running through the house, that's pretty much the way that it was.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. You know, they fell in love. She had been a Red Cross woman in World War II under Patton. And you know, she'd been at the liberation of Buchenwald and all that, and had been severely injured on the front lines. And my dad had been in the Mexican army. He was a captain and had been forced to do really awful things and was haunted by it. So I think she saw relief in him and he saw relief in her. And when they were married in San Francisco, and he was very Irish looking. I mean, my family, even though we're on that side, we're Mexican, it's really Basque and Irish. Urrea is a Basque name. It means men of gold. Mm-hmm. And my grandma, Mama Lupita, we called her, was her real name was Guadalupe Murray. So my dad was Alberto Urrea Murray, but Murray is really Murray. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he looked like Errol Flynn. And she thought all Mexicans looked like that. And off they went to Tijuana, you know, and it went sour immediately. And it was pretty awful. But I was a very devout Catholic boy in those days. I wanted to be a priest, which, ironically enough, made my father decide that I was going to be gay, that only homosexuals were priests, in his opinion. And he began this campaign of macho terror to try to force me to be He-Man, whatever that's supposed to be. My mom, you know, I think facing the shame and horror in her mind of suddenly being on a dirt street in Tijuana and then basically in the ghetto in San Diego, just retreated into herself. And they didn't get along, and it got worse and worse. But I was sure they would go to hell if they got a divorce. So we were chained in this bizarre unhappiness. You know, it was a two-bedroom apartment. So quite literally, she had her room, he had his room. And they had sides of the living room, and they wouldn't even touch. They wouldn't, I never saw them hug each other or touch in any way. They would very carefully not touch, and they would sit and snipe at each other, and then he would go off on his adventures at night. It was the weirdest thing. And, you know, now when I find myself writing about the border, I realized, certainly on this tour especially, that what I write about is borders all the time. But it's not about the Mexican border, which is just a crude metaphor. It's about that border between us as people.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point we have a couple of minutes left. I'm interested in hearing you talk about your thoughts or expectations or fears for the movie of Hummingbird's Daughter. It's a wonderful book, and it's a very big story, and
yeah,
it would be a great challenge to make a movie of this. And I'm sure that a lot of people have beloved books that they have seen made into movies and that make them really unhappy because of the way the story has to be pared down.
I think most of them are unhappy. They are. But, you know, you hope for the best and you kiss your book farewell and send it forth. It's a message in a bottle in a way, you know. And Stephen King once said, well, the book is still on the shelf after the movie's come and gone. So, you know, it doesn't affect my book. So I don't know. You know, Beautiful North is right on the verge of being bought by a director right now. And but it's a woman, for one, which I think is really exciting. And she's really good. That's all I'm free to say. But Hummingbird, you know, it's allegedly, as far as I know, starring Antonio Banderas as the dad and Ivana Baquero from Pan's Labyrinth as Teresita, the hummingbird's daughter. The director is a Mexican director named Luis Mandoki, and he's a really cool guy. You know, we like him very much. My wife and I have gotten to know him fairly well. He's written a fantastic script. He was terrified when he wrote the script to show it to me because he thought I would be angry because, you know, you take a 700-page epic and reduce it down to what looks like 127 pages of poetry. You figure a lot has been lost, but he's captured things really well. And, you know, I think the movie is in a way just almost like a jazz improvisation on a melody. You know what I mean? The best they can do is try to reach the feeling, the essence of what the book is about. And I think he sees it that way.
Well, I guess I remember having talked about this one point with a fellow I knew who used to be a professor of cinema studies here. And I think his take sort of was, well, you know, a book is a book and a movie is a movie. And maybe the best that you can hope is that you can take something, you know, you have a good book and you can take something from that book and make a good movie. But those two things are going to be completely different, and you can't really, I think perhaps he would say, each thing has to stand and be judged as what it is.
Yeah.
And it's maybe unfair to say, oh, well, they ruined my book that I love by making this movie. Well, don't, you know, you got to take the movie for what it, if you can, take the movie for what it is on its own merits and go with that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I have to accept the film as his art. You know, it is his vision and his art, and he's taken some liberties with my story, but they're interesting liberties, and they seem to be, he's really focusing in his script and what he's doing on illuminating elements in my story to make them a visceral thing. And I've learned a lot about writing from watching him adapt for the screen, because he has a way of finding one gesture that encompasses 100 pages of my prose. And it's really interesting to see. And I think it'll be good for me to watch that discipline that he's having to exert over the material.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say. I've used the time. Our guest, Luis Alberto Urrea, is professor of creative writing at University of Illinois Chicago. Look for his novels, Hummingbird's Daughter, the new one, Into the Beautiful North. It's published by Little Brown. Devil's Highway, also you might want to look at that book. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2004. And one of these days, there'll be a movie of Hummingbird's Daughter, and
yes,
one of these days, there'll be a sequel. So we'll look forward to it. Hey, thanks very much for
talking
to us.
Thank you. Great talking to you.